Hi, welcome to Unlimited Life. It's Nicole Brandon, and we have such an exciting show today. We're talking about green architecture and sacred architecture, and it's amazing because the more people that I told that this is what we were discussing today, they said, what an incredible topic. What a great subject to be talking about on Unlimited Life, to be able to, we talk about living the life of your dreams and being across those borders and across those lines, and how do you connect to the all that is, and in a really wonderful way. Today's guest is really what we would say the cherry on the sundae. He is an expert in this field. We're talking today with Jeffrey Collins, and Jeffrey is world-renowned architect and community consultant on sustainability. He's currently working under Jeffrey Collins Living Designs, and he's been in partnership with SCO Green Architecture. He specializes in a very unique niche of organic spaces with spirit. And SCO Designs primarily designed residential projects, community plans, multifamily projects. During that time, Jeffrey's talent has led their design team's projects for over the last 20 years. He works individually with his clients to really combine thoughtful aesthetics with green practicality. And we're going to talk about how he does that. And the result is really this unique and sustainable space that fits his clients' unique visions and needs. He's designed projects from Los Angeles, Nevada, New Mexico, and even just the aesthetically gorgeous Japan. His permaculture training provided him incredible opportunities of experimentation. And he's even applied some of these principles for the city, such as rainwater catchment and gray water reuse and organic gardening and natural buildings, and I'm so excited to talk about all those things. And Jeffrey always says that now is a really important time to do more with less. And he really loves to show his clients how they can get partially off the grid, both with energy and with water needs, and how they can create an organic sanctuary, which I love that idea of having an organic sanctuary through smart design. And his specialties really include the application of green low-tech systems, maximizing sustainability in all urban environments. He's produced master plans for business campuses and communities, and his expertise, which I love, if you have to have an expertise, to have an expertise in creating simple, beautiful buildings that enhance the lives of his clients. And that's just, it's so beautiful. He first started working with Mike Reynolds of Earthship fame, and he really ingrained the principles of sustainable natural recycling building. And after getting 2 degrees in architecture, he's worked with Frank Gehry, and he's been all over the board. His bio is absolutely amazing. And he's since obtained permaculture design certificate, and he continues to build eco villages and conscious architecture. And his goal is to continue doing sustainable, socially just designs that educate people of the possibilities of living in shelters that are beautiful in a way to take care of themselves. He's even adopted a public median from the city of Los Angeles, creating beautiful community projects, which are gateways for the city, involving permaculture principles and community cohesion. And that's not even to mention that he's designed the site plan layouts and major structures for a traveling 200-plus person village. And he's worked closely with teams to promote conscious living and alchemy. And after 15 years with SCO as his flagship, he's now expanded his repertoire, and he's really focusing his business on green community planning, permaculture, sustainable technology, and everything that we imagine and dream of having sacred living spaces and what it's like to be closer to the earth and closer to consciousness as a way of actually housing our body, our souls, and our lives. And so I am so thrilled and excited to welcome today's guest, Jeffrey Collins. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nicole. Great to be here.
Wow, what an incredible bio. What an incredible journey. One of the things that I'm always interested in when I'm talking to guests of your caliber and somebody that's literally broken so many boundaries and has helped so many people with such a conscious vision is that when you were little, you know, we talk about on the show when you were 6 and 7 and someone says, I want to be a fireman or an architect or, you know, a doctor or a vet. Did you know when you were little that you wanted to build things?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, thanks for the colorful introduction. When I was young, It is. It is. I was thinking about that today. What is my background, and how did I get here? And I know that. I think I was. My dad worked for a company that moved his family to Europe in the 70s, and so between the ages of 6 and 12, I lived in Europe, in Frankfurt and Brussels, and flew around a lot and visited Africa and things like that in that time. So I had a unique opportunity probably as a kid to start to question my environment, you know, just sort of changing perspectives. And I do remember starting to diagram buildings and spaceships and things, but looking at the, you know, the principles of the plans or the sections in my sketches when I was around 7. So I suppose that just carried through and informed my career choices.
It's so amazing because the first time I met you, and you know, and I'm really honored and really blessed because I get to bring on the show the very best experts in the world, in the top of their field, and it's always a joy for me when I've actually met them in person and I know their work, and I'm such a huge fan of yours, and even for those of you who are listening to the show and who are new to Jeffrey's work, even when I went to buy my own home, you were the very first person I called. It was you that I trusted. But the first time that I ever met you, you were building a conscious community, and I saw you there in creation mode. You were actually, you know, putting this community together. And I literally, you know, I saw you from across the way, and I was watching you and didn't know who you were. But building for you conscious community was as natural for me as watching a dolphin swim in water. It was like you were so connected and so part of everything. It was beautiful and astonishing to see. And then in getting to know you, and I know your experience and your expertise and your talent, it's really magical. And so how did you go from, okay, now I know something about building and wanting to draw things, to being able to be conscious and build communities and change people's lives in the way that you have?
It does come naturally to me. I mean, having been in the building trade for a couple decades, as an architect, you have to be sort of the quarterback between different aspects of a project, and it's kind of like, you know, maybe producing a film or a TV show, and some of the work that you've done, where you have a lot of different pieces of the puzzle that you have to bring the glue to. You know, you have to bring people together. And so it's a kind of delicate thing because there's lots of different personalities involved in projects that size, like making a film, you know, where you have like 20 different very talented people all trying to do this one vision. So, and it's only with their talents that the project becomes whole. So you have to really be able to be the type of person that can empower people around you, not just tell them what to do, you know. That's a key ingredient. There's been some projects I've worked on where there's sort of the someone that's kind of bossy or temperamental, and it creates problems. And but I just I grew up in a family. I'm the youngest of 4 kids, and I remember when I came back from Europe and when I was a teenager, we lived on a farm, and there was kind of surrounded by suburbs, so a lot of kids wanted to come over and play at my place. And we built. We started building clubhouses, several versions. And I was sort of the wrangling that gang and creating the. I really loved it as a child. It ingrained something in me about hand building and really like actually constructing myself, which I still love to do. And I try to keep that that ability. And so because I know how to actually build something, people, you know, listen to me more, or, you know, people that might think I'm more of a director type, I suppose. And then when I was out of high school, that's when I went to work for Mike Reynolds building the Earthships, and my sister Jenny and Tracy, they live in Taos, New Mexico, and Santa Fe. And so Jenny invited me to Taos because she was working with Mike Reynolds and her boyfriend at the time. And I got firsthand, you know, from an early in my career, how the sort of paradigm shift of realizing this possibility of attaining freedom through smart design and building. And having worked with Mike Reynolds directly and built these Earthship homes, which for your listeners, it is built out of very simple materials, most recycled, and creates beautiful interior spaces that are completely heated in sub-zero temperatures without any fossil fuels, because they're designed as passive solar homes. And that's the miracle, that when you're in Taos and it's 10 below, these houses are you can wear a t-shirt, walk around in a t-shirt. You don't need to make a fire. There's no mechanical systems heating the house. It's really, that's the most incredible thing about them. But then you also get that they are also taking care of their own water supply and from the sky, sophisticated rain catchment systems and gray water that goes through the planters that then grows food for you. And they really do. There's huge banana plants and lush food gardens in the front of the Earthships, right on the solar face. And so you've got it all. You've got the three areas that a house can really make you sustainable is one, food, two, water, and three, energy. So they're using, you know, active solar panels and some wind turbines. And so, in other words, you're completely off the grid. You can go build this 100 miles away, you know, without any lines going to it. All those things are taken care of from the natural world right around you. So once you get that sense of freedom, then it invites a whole different conversation about how we build and design. Yeah.
Now, are there the Earthship homes that you're talking about other than Taos, New Mexico? I mean, are there homes like that in California and other places, or can we get a home like this?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people are experimenting with this kind of technology all over the world. The Earthships are being built in other countries in different forms. They have to kind of adapt to their independent environment somewhat, which is a key question, because these work well in a cold place, right, because they're heating these houses. So they may not be great for Southern California in the same form, but you can adapt the form for specific climates. But yes, there's a big demonstration village of Earthships in Taos, New Mexico. And if you're interested, that's the coolest place to visit them.
That's phenomenal. I remember many years ago, I was in Arizona, and I went to the Biosphere, is that right? And they had the Biosphere Project.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all of the different environments, and they grew everything inside. And I mean, it was almost like Noah's Ark, but being inside. And to me, that was astonishing. That something could be sustainable inside this bubble was just magical to me.
Yeah, it's exciting possibility. So it's. I think a lot of people are kind of checking it out these days. But there's also some, you know, with a little education, I like to believe that there's simple solutions for people. But I did want to kind of go back through my traditional professional training to kind of paraphrase how this all works, if I may.
Absolutely.
So I went to University of Cincinnati, you know, got my kind of Western professional architecture training. And then I got my master's at SciArc in LA and worked for Frank Gehry. But first of all, studying at UC, we started with, you know, kind of Greek architecture and the Western model that was put forth originally by this guy named Vitruvius, who was a scientist.
Great name.
Isn't that a cool name? About
Great
it seems
name.
To be virtuous. Yeah, his name was Vitruvius, and he wrote the 10 books of architecture. And it's funny because it's like the most sort of basic of Western architectural history. But when I look at it as an adult, having kind of come full circle through all of this, I realize that those basic trainings were very much about sacred geometry and what works for the public buildings that have been built throughout Europe and and early America. And so there's a number of factors here. Not only are we doing sort of a green practical application, but it's, I always find it important to look at the examples of architecture, the way that, you know, Washington, D.C. is laid out. It's very much very geometric, very well thought out. And those certain applications evoke certain energies. And so there's a way to, you know, face your house in a certain direction. And the floor plan itself of a house has to reflect, if you want to do green architecture, it's about the shape of the house as much as it is about these technical. So just in case, you know, the idea of green architecture is lost on only the technical, there's a whole other layer of architecture that is an important aspect of it all.
So is that sort of like, is it feng shui for the energy and spirit, or is it because the sun rises in a certain direction or sets, and it's the lighting, or, I mean, why is the direction so important?
Well, it is both. I mean, it's when you're designing, every site should receive a unique architecture, and I'm a little worried about a lot of the prefab homes that some people are jumping into, because they don't necessarily, well, they can, but it's important in any case that every house should be sort of an original for its site, because you're thinking of views, you're thinking of the direction of the wind, you're thinking of the, you know, orientation to the sun. But there is something about the energy of the land, and that is kind of like feng shui. You can sort of sense it in an intuitive sense, at least some people can, and they say, well, God, it feels good over here for some reason. Maybe there's like a stream that's running through. And this is what the Gaelic druids would you know, they have the dowsing rods, or they would kind of intuit what was the best way to place a castle, for example. But also the Chinese and the geomancy, that's the very first thing they do before they build anything, even today. If they go build a skyscraper in Shanghai, they definitely have their geomancer come out and assess the energy lines in the earth as a practical first step in building. So this is also something that I think we could pick up on more, because we don't pay attention to it in the Western world anymore. But I think the origins of architecture did do that. And so I try to, I'm not necessarily, certified geomancer, but I think that one can kind of pick up on the best orientations for a house based on the feel of the land.
That's so amazing. I mean, when I think about getting 2 degrees in architecture and obtaining a permaculture, you know, certificate, and then a lot of what you're talking about now as far as catching the water catchment or the gray water reuse, or the organic gardening, those are things that people can do right now in their own homes or their own spaces, can't they?
Yeah, I could talk about that a little bit. Especially, you know, I've been in Los Angeles for the last 24 years, and we're going through a drought. We're going through a big crisis, and I've had great success and had a lot of fun catching rainwater. And in fact, there's an unprecedented new movement or law in the city of Los Angeles. They're proposing that new construction is required to have water catchment. This is really revolutionary, because there were some people in other states maybe that were starting to outlaw rainwater catchment, which is absurd, unless maybe you're building a huge pond and it's blocking your neighbor's access or something. But now in L.A., let's put in these tanks, you know, 1,000-gallon tank. You can bury it. You can do a pretty simple installation and get tons of rainwater off your roof. It gets filtered. It's used for irrigation. And I think in the next decade we're going to see this happen kind of by law, that everyone really can't irrigate. You can't just water your lawn from this water that comes from Colorado or the Owens Valley. Los Angeles is actually the most unsustainable metropolis on the planet. it's not meant to be here. You know, it was created by Mulholland and the water grab from the Owens Valley. And we continue to pull water in, and the legal implications and cost of water soon is going to be more of an issue. So, but it does fall from the sky. We do usually get about 10 inches a year or more. And hopefully we'll get some more this winter before it's out. But really important, homeowners right now can get small tanks in place, even like a couple of 55-gallon barrels. I know City of Santa Monica gives you a free one. So there are some programs that encourage you to hook up your own little thing off the downspout of your roof from the gutters and collect water so that you can save it. Try not to use it from your hose. It's also much healthier. Just also real quick, is that water from the hose, all the city tap water has chlorine in it, which is unhealthy to drink, and it's not great for plants either. It usually off-gasses. It's not terrible, but it's much better, much healthier to get rainwater into your garden than it is hose water.
I love that. I mean, it's so incredible just to think about all of the things that we can do now to change, and especially, like you're saying, if we're building something fresh. If we're building something, I mean, so many people here, as we're talking about building a new life or an unlimited life or a way to be able to do that and to be able to be off the grid, to be able to be sustainable, to be able to be connected to the environment. And I know that you and I were talking earlier about sacred architecture. And so what is sacred architecture to you?
Yeah. Well, there's this sense of when you do, you know, have a house that's completely off the grid, you have to really, you don't rely on the oil companies, but you start relying on the patterns of nature or becoming more aware of them. And you feel a deeper connection to the earth inevitably, because if it rains and your solar panels aren't getting enough energy, you're you know, sort of more concerned about the weather, and, you know, that's just one small example. So anyway, we build a relationship, a deeper relationship with the earth, and you start to understand why our ancestors really prayed for rain and or sun, and that we seem to be able to make a difference in the environment around us. And why is that? I mean, what, you know, we are one with the earth, where our connection with the earth is one and the same. So I'm, you know, in favor of, I like, you know, Native American studies and paganism is a weird word, but like today is Imbolc is a earth holiday of the earth, but it just makes sense because today, February 1st, is the halfway point between the solstice and equinox in the spring, and you'd say big deal, but there is some kind of turning point, and when you celebrate and become aware of these kind of cycles of nature, then it is a kind of spiritual practice. So I would hope that people building and designing have a clue about these things, because they usually don't. I know my permaculture teacher, Mike Reynolds, a lot of people didn't necessarily embrace this spiritual quotient. But I feel it's there. And then there's the whole sacred geometry of construction also. If you build, you know, a room that's a certain shape, like an octagon shape, it implies certain things. It's got four sides and then four other sides, so you're automatically referencing the four directions, and you can, you know, you're tuning into that at some level. And then, you know, a globe or a hexagon mean other very specific things, and they can, I think, evoke an energy. I've practiced with it mostly at with our movable village, Red Lightning.
Yeah,
we did some awesome sacred geometry experiments, and we worked on gender alchemy. We acknowledged the kind of separateness and importance of having a men's group meet just among men and strengthen their what they are as men, and women also kind of meeting in the teepee, and finding their strength, and then coming together and being a healthier community, having acknowledged the power of our individual genders, and then creating a space for that. So I was just assigned to make a village around that kind of concept, and I worked with some amazing people to bring a working mobile village, you know, with an infrastructure for power and water and food and everything out into a desert for a week or two. And I've done that multiple times on the playa.
It's such a talent, and I would love to get into the movable community and the playa, but I just want to jump back for just a second. We have a question from one of our listeners about the states where it's illegal to catch rainwater. And so is there something else that people can do, or are there some things that the listeners can do at home right now?
I hope that your listener hasn't experienced the, you know, actual law against catching rainwater firsthand. I've heard of a few instances where people have been penalized for it. I imagine if you do a small system, you know, by yourself as a pioneer, that no one's going to really care. But if you are in an environment where you're being scrutinized for it, I would advise using what is becoming a precedent in what Los Angeles is doing and trying to embrace the permit process. Most people say, no, I don't want to get permits. It's too much, you know, red tape. But all it is you talking to other people that have your best interests at heart, hopefully, and explaining why it's more valuable. So if more of us can be leaders and say, look, no, it's actually better for the community if I catch rainwater because, you know, we're taking a load off the water system, which is imperiled. And I hope that using the precedent of what Los Angeles is doing as a requirement to catch rainwater, then we can convince these code officials or whoever would ban you from doing it. I hope that helps.
It does. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And thank you so much for the question. You know, I always love when people reach out, and especially, you know, clarifying something, because these are such important issues right now. And the fact that it can be done, that we can make a difference and you can be sustainable. And so I would love for you, you know, to talk about and continue to talk about. So you built, for those that don't know what the playa is and for those that don't know what red lightning is, that can you explain a little bit about what this experience is and also how you can build a conscious community for a couple weeks? Now, where does that conscious community go? And then I know in your bio that you were saying that you've built a 200-plus person village and traveling villages or traveling structures, and I would love you to share what that looks like as well, because that just sounds so exciting.
Well, that was the Red Lightning Camp, basically, at Burning Man. And I had the fortunate opportunity to be introduced to Burning Man about 15 years ago. And as an architect, I was very interested in doing installation art. And I found that it is, in fact, the greatest gallery in the world of large-scale sculpture. And they give art tours and have the most amazing kind of analysis of really meaningful artwork out there. And that's what intrigued me so much. And then I'd since been kind of hired on to be an architect of large camps out there and other festivals and communities where it's carte blanche. It's like, you know, doing architecture as art and really having a chance to combine that with, you know, a group of people living together and the intricacies involved, you know, which is very much, like I said, a core group project and brings up a lot of opportunities to create, to form a team and to learn how to work in teamwork. And then I'm also the co-founder of an intentional community in Topanga that I started 8 years ago, about 9 years ago. We started talking about it and bought land in Topanga and created a permanent intentional community also. So really a lot of the same principles involved, especially when you have a group of people. You need a vision statement. You need a common kind of basis to work off of. And if you can't find that common basis, then you have to question whether it's right for you. It's really important that everybody's on the same page so that when you go through these differences of opinion and trials of applications, that you can come back to that common vision. So it's this kind of social architecture that is most important, and I have a lot of friends that have practiced with me in these areas that we're learning. I feel like we've been chosen to learn how to do this at this time for some reason. It just seems like it's coming up a lot. Like, people want to know about living in community. They need the tools to live in community. And the people I've worked with in these projects have gained some really valuable information on how this can be done in the most efficient and harmonious way.
Okay, so now I have a question, you know, which, because I do a lot of charity work. And, I mean, I've worked with over 100 charities, and so I've worked in third world countries and disaster relief. And so many times you'll see a situation like we had in Katrina where all these people are in a baseball stadium and they're getting sick and they're, you know, crowded together and there's not enough food and there's not enough water. Can we not set up something in advance as far as the community living, or you're talking about tribal oasis or water sustainability, or intentionality, that in case of a disaster or an emergency, that there is a way to live sustainably and healthy and connected and together instead of the chaos that we create in emergencies?
That's great. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for bringing us to that point, because you're right. Right now, if something major happened, like, would everybody know what to do, you know? And it's getting more and more common, as we know, through crazy weather and stuff. You know, what happened up in New York and New Jersey with that storm last year was ridiculous. So I would answer that from a couple of different perspectives. One is, yes, I have learned how to organize people. Yes, I've learned how to get offline, how to function offline and gather my own water and power. So I, myself and a team of people like myself, hopefully we could form like an outreach to people in those situations, but also trying to empower everybody right now about how to do that. Like, if there was suddenly no power, big cities would start to go into chaos within a week or two. So like, how do you make power right now? And there's totally ways. I mean, you can do it on your exercise bike. You can connect through an alternator or a generator to your car battery and have enough power to turn on your laptop or run a couple lights. Things like that, little practical tidbits. Boiling water that you take out of a stream that doesn't look so great. Filter it, boil it, you can drink it. There's a lot of friends in the permaculture, LA Permaculture Guild and others that are showing us how we can have grains around, a lot of a storage of grain, and then you can actually sprout the grain in jars and have like 10 jars full of sprouts. It's really healthy food that you can have in like a day. You know, so there's ways but you don't have to, you know, but you can't cook maybe, or so there's some research I think we should all do. But I love your question, Nicole, and I wonder, maybe you and I can follow up on having a forum or some kind of education series or something around this very issue.
Absolutely. I would love to, because it's really important. It's truly, and when you know it's available and it's accessible and it's possible and it's doable, and not only is it doable, but it's even a better way of life than we know how to live now, and a healthier way of living, and a connection that's even more beautiful and more profound. And instead of being in fear, and instead of being in angst, or instead of losing so many people during emergencies, instead we could be sustaining so many people.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Oh.
And I know that when you're talking about building the way you build, the spiritual connections, and when we were talking once, you were sharing about how ancient tribes had a connection with the land. And even now, that there is a way to be more connected with the land. And so how does that work as far as the importance for each individual to have that spiritual connection in their building and in their space?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some traditions that are kind of left over of, you know, having spiritual protection for a house. You know, you can hang things by your door, or a lot of different traditions have, you know, ways that were originated from people recognizing the spiritual layer in structures in their houses and the way they design them. So it's, you know, we can start to like evoke that from those traditions, even, you know, sometimes out. I'm currently on the coast of Maine, in a small town. With snow outside, it's not my usual environment, but I am here for family reasons, and you see different traditions here on the East Coast that are hundreds of years old. I'm actually the sixth generation that's occupied this house, believe it or not. It's been in the family a couple hundred years, and so there's I see people, you know, they really had to kind of subsist and pay attention to practical and sort of spiritual aspects that were happening. So they're, you know, celebrating like the return of the light, and people put candles in the window, and it's a way of kind of coaxing the light on our way into spring. And those are just some examples, but I think if people don't discard those beliefs or potential applications, and
are
have
there
faith.
Are there ones that are kind of universal? Because I know, you know, businesses you put outside your house to protect you, you know, may you know, all inside this house, you know, may no harm come to you and may harm pass. And then the old Egyptian things you would see, like, in front of the kings or the buildings, the dragons or the Pegasus, or and in some homes they have water, you know, streams when you come in, or these beautiful rose gardens. And is there something kind of universal that just says I'm connected to this land?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really relish discovering and enhancing those things in my architecture. You know, just the simplicity of a base or a cornerstone. For this house I did in Japan, this pyramidal house, I was proposing, you know, you take an old stone from history, and that is the first thing you place as you build the house. So you build this furniture, this cornerstone, and that sort of grounds you into the place. And then, yes, water in the entranceway is a great thing for houses and businesses alike to evoke abundance. I've seen it in a lot of restaurants, and I've proposed that in a restaurant that I designed in Egypt, that it was on the Nile, and so I brought that water inside as if you were like crossing over the Nile to from the front door into the eatery itself. And so there are the four elements that we like to try and evoke too. Well, when I talk about green architecture, I kind of compare it to the four elements. That at the top you have air, and you think about that spiritual level, and also about the health quality of the air inside to make sure you don't use any toxic materials. This is another big thing that is the LEEDs certification, and what a lot of people focus on in green architecture is making sure you have healthy materials, because they're building plywood has horrible chemicals in it that leach out, and you breathe that, and it makes you unhealthy. So it's really important when we build to make sure that we're using solid, healthy materials, and that really improves one's mood and one's atmosphere. And then on kind of, if that were at the top of the wheel on either side, you would then have like fire and water, and I liken that to power and plumbing and electrical. I mean, electrical and actual water supply. And then how are we doing that? Are we doing it in a conventional way that is using a fuel that is non-renewable, or is it are we doing it from a sustainable standpoint, as we've already discussed? And then at the bottom of the circle is Earth, and that's actually where you start. You start from there up, and you look at the land, the energies of the land, and as I say, with the way you create the foundation and the base, and actually maybe even minimizing your footprint on the Earth quite literally, or using the materials of the land in the foundation, like the stone and things that you don't have to bring from hundreds of miles away, to try and use the local woods or incorporate the spirit of the place in your construction. So that's a kind of full circle way of looking of how I would like approach any project and question these aspects, these basic aspects of the architecture.
That's so fantastic. I mean, that's so phenomenal when you think about it. And I love when you talk about Earth. I know that I've done a lot of work with the Pachamama Alliance, and I love their mission statement because it's to create an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just human presence on our planet.
Mm-hmm.
Which is such a beautiful mission statement. But they always talk about how some people call it dirt and other people call it Earth.
Mm.
And when you say Earth, how flowers grow, plants, minerals, and Earth has so much power and life. And I love when you talk about the Earth, because every time you say it, I feel that power. And I feel that energy as you talk about that planet.
Neat. Oh, that's such a wonderful work that you guys do. Excuse me, at the Pachamama Alliance. And I think for more indigenous people and people with a rich history, that stuff is just common sense. It's the most important thing. For my friends on the Pueblo and Taos Pueblo, you know, or for the local Hawaiian people, they have terms in their language that just say, well, yeah, obviously we have to honor the Mother Earth, and you know, it becomes a practice, a daily practice of hopefully that remains in their building projects and their future designs.
When I think about you, you know, I've been to your office and you have papers everywhere and your draft tables and your designs, and it's so great. I mean, it's so joyful just to see the future and the creative process. And how does it work for you? Do you first feel an energy and space and you see what should be there, or do people come to you and say, you know, I want a garden on top of my office building, or I want to create a community here, or I'm looking to have a home that brings me abundance and wealth and you know, health and wisdom, and how do people find you, and where do you begin?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And that talks more about, you know, my last couple decades in L.A., you know, since I've had my own practice. I started around 93 after getting my master's at SciArc and working for Frank Gehry and doing a more kind of fancy architectural viewpoint, I'd say. And when I started my own practice, I was getting some very, you know, kind of practical applications immediately after looking at all of that sort of more sculptural aspect of architecture. But it's really fun to bring the two together, and that's my job. That's like my dharma. It's like the client... The client, I mean, I realize this now, is that I'm good at interpreting the needs of the client. You know, people that are driving the project are the ones that are paying for it. And my service is to interpret what their needs are and to give them the best advice I can based on my experience. So sometimes it's not what they wanted to hear. Like if someone says, hey, I want to do a garden on the roof, I might say, well, that's a really bad idea out here in Palm Springs where it's so dry it's going to die, or something like that. it's been fun then to bring the artful, try to imply an artistic beauty, you know, an aesthetic to the house at the same time, because you kind of have to come from that point of view. You know, you have to kind of say, what style of architecture do you want? Some people really have something specific in mind, and I'm all for an architecture that reflects its place. You know, for example, where I am here in New England, it would be really wrong to build some crazy, colorful, modern piece of architecture right next to all these beautiful old houses, you know what I mean? So you have to be very responsive to the context of the place as well as the needs of the client. But if on a blank scale, what I learned from the Southern California Institute of Architecture, where I studied with, you know, some of the top modern architects in the world, and for Frank Gehry, who, you know, most of you have probably heard of this guy who designed the Walt Disney Concert Hall and some other pretty wild stuff, is that is an organic architecture. We don't have to limit ourselves to boxes and cubes and preconceptions necessarily. There's a great value in history, but I'd like to see an architecture that responds to its environment and kind of fits in a more fluid way, if possible, and that it might even be a biomimicry of the local flora and fauna, perhaps, so that it has a very shapely quality. I'm a big fan of Frank Lloyd Wright, even though his work is fairly modern. Some of his protégés have introduced a beautiful kind of organic architecture. That's sort of a style. It's the best way to describe it. And so I would encourage clientele to take risks with the shape of the building as we go through the process of fulfilling their needs in the building.
I love this word biomimicry. It's a great word.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. It's like permaculture. There's some people that use it as a playbook, you know, because they watch how nature works, and that's kind of what permaculture does, is you see how different things work together and support each other and become closed-loop, self-sustainable systems. So then you incorporate their practices of nature into whatever you're doing, if it's running a business or building a house. But I like the idea of literally like taking a look at insects or animals and the way that they're put together and considering making a house like that or a building.
You know, when you talk about the energy of creation, I know that one of the things that has been a passion in your past and part of your life is also designing furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that something do you just feel that if somebody's going to be sitting or somebody's going to, that they should be in a place where they're wrapped in nature or that the energy is centered from the earth? Or how did you get into the designing furniture aspect?
Well, you know, I started from the humble roots of building clubhouses and putting stuff together with my own hands, which I really, really enjoy. And, you know, fashioning used materials or found materials into something else. I think that's there's a real alchemy and a real magic that happens there. It's when you manifest a building or any building project, it really is like magic in that you have a pile of stuff and then you turn it into something else through your own wit. And so I got, you know, I just practiced with furniture building and putting stuff together. And it was actually a course at the Southern California Institute of Architecture at SciArc. There was this guy named Randall who taught us how to, you know, plane a board down and make a chair. It was part of an assignment in our architecture school. Because I think if you get the basics at that level of how people touch things, you know, how you look at the tangibility of architecture. There's some architects that really get these subtleties and the way your body fits into a curve and things like that. You can really only learn by designing very intimate pieces like furniture.
This is such an amazing journey. It really is. And so when you're talking about how water elements outside our house can create abundance, is there anything that our listeners can do to create that, or even simple things in their house as far as learning the directions of the sun or the placement of even outdoor furniture or things that they can do to bring about a more peaceful environment? Or is there a way to hire you for consultation, even just to look at their house and how to see how their house can flow better?
Absolutely. You know, based on my experience, I'm really eager to help people on a basic course of improving their immediate environment. I think everyone who's been listening is realizing that there's some real dramatic changes can take place in your space if you pay attention and do a smart design. You know, it might literally give you a lot more abundance and health to just do a few adjustments to your environment. You know, maybe there's a little fountain that you can plug in and you have the sound of water when you enter. I think that's just it creates this immediate sense of peace and oneness in any space, especially when you first, you know, when you walk in and leave your house. Creating a hearth, or if you don't have a traditional fireplace, start to think of what is your kind of altar. What is special to you? Where do you like to sit? You know, building your own personal altar and giving energy to an area that has photographs of things that are meaningful to you, like a lot of us do. You know, pictures of our relatives or special objects. Just creating your own personal altar is a great thing to do in your house. And if you're cold in your house, really try and expose the southern exposure. Passive solar energy is so amazing, and what the sunlight needs to get into your house or greenhouse as much as possible and hit mass and get thermal mass heated up during the day. So you can even have like vessels of water or bottles sitting around that are catching the sun in the daytime, and they're literally like staying warm, staying 70 degrees all night long, well, into the night and releasing their heat in the cold evening. That's something that, you know, anyone can do in a relatively sunny place. Maybe add more windows on your south side if it's cold in your house, for sure.
So how do you do that with the water? You would take just a bottle of water and unscrew the cap or a bowl and just lay it out there and then bring those in during the evening?
Well, no, I mean, in the front of a solar face or a glass, if you let the sun hit a concrete floor, that's doing the same thing. You really want to try and get the sun to hit a thermal mass. But if you don't really have that, if you even put like a couple of 5-gallon plastic jugs of water in the path of the sun, then it will heat up to 70, 80 degrees in the daytime, and then it will stay that warm and literally release that heat at night. That's just a kind of crude way of adding thermal mass in the path of the sun inside your house. So, well, you don't really have to move it around. It's more about just placing it inside in a sunny place.
That's fabulous. So when you talk about creating an altar for people that this is a new process for them, are there suggestions as far as you were talking about finding like an ancient stone and building the house around that? Or finding pictures that are meaningful to you? Are there things that work better from the land to be able to place in your altar or bring into your home that add that energy and that consciousness?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, if you have some special things from outside, it reminds me of this classic example of architecture that Frank Lloyd Wright did in his building called Falling Water in Pennsylvania. The family that commissioned him used to go down to the creek and build a fire on this ledge next to the creek outside to camp out. So when he designed the house at that location, he built the whole house around that rock And that rock was the base of the hearth or the fireplace inside the house. And so they always had that sense of specialness in their home. But maybe you could like take something from outside, you know, some shells or some rocks, and bring the outside in and have a sense of place. That's special to you for sure.
Gosh, that's wonderful. And then I had a question about, you were talking about on your bio in Venice Beach that you received a grant. Is that what it was? To be able to, can you talk about that? And because I love that idea, and even if we, there's a way to expand that or do that in more communities.
Sure. How are we doing on time, by the way, Nicole?
We're perfect. We're great.
Okay.
You're doing that.
I love architecture in the public realm. I mean, that's a big thing that I wish could happen more. It happens a lot more in Europe because there's more of a sense of, I don't know, community or maybe history, where they have, you know, wonderful clock towers in the town square and a really beautiful paving, and they put a lot of energy into the place where people gather on, in the public realm. So I'm always looking for opportunities to do that, and Burning Man really helped me see this too, is that people are spending to get grants from Burning Man to help build these incredible, beautiful sculptures, and then they're actually bringing them back home into their cities and talking to the city councils and getting further grants to install these interactive sculptures in public spaces in the city. So there's a kind of awakening or an enlivening of the city. So you're not just walking through this dreary row of concrete boxes. You're getting excited by being out on the sidewalk and in the public space. So what I did is that I realized back in, well, this must have been about 10 years ago at first, kind of well-known landscape architect named Jay Griffith in Venice said, hey, you know, you should adopt this piece of land on the side of the road. And it was right across from Frank Gehry's Binocular building, which is where Google has just moved into. Silicon Beach, their first LA headquarters. So it's become a very even more activated area. But even before that, I went ahead and filed the process in the city, proposed it to the Venice Neighborhood Council, was agreed to be a grant recipient to help fix up the space. And what happened was kind of unexpected. I was just, you know, trying to keep it kempt, but all these volunteers came out because everybody wants to do this. And if they're invited to say, hey, come play and let's work together to improve the space, then again, I was just kind of the conduit for a team to come together and put their energy into the space. And it is kind of a gateway entrance into Venice. When you first are driving south on Main Street past Rose, it's just on the right. And it was just a sort of dirty strip, and now it's this wonderful, lush thing. We built these retaining walls and put in the irrigation and made a beautiful place for people to be, because they come from all over the world to go right there and photograph this famous building. And now they, you know, have a attractive place to visit and right in front of that building.
I love that you talk about a community cohesion, too. That is not about this different kind of an energy there.
Definitely, definitely. And I think permaculture and these community groups can really do more of this. People in Portland have something called City Repair. There's this guy named Mark Lakeman and his team at City Repair. They're doing this on a huge scale. They've done amazing things in Portland, Oregon, by inviting the neighbors to meet at a certain time and propose a fixing of the city. They call it City Repair because they're kind of fixing what he sees as broken, these intersections where cars are pouring through, where the kids are playing. So how do you get the kids to slow down at these intersections and people to interact? So they go out and they get approval from the city, and they paint the whole intersection in sort of like a sacred circle, and then they build little earthen cob tea houses and really wonderful opportunities for people to stop and rest and share books and have tea and interact with each other.
I love that. Oh my gosh, how sweet.
Yeah. And then there's the, this reminds me of the Transition Town movement, which is another way for, as a community, because there's really kind of three different ways of community. There's this utopian ideal where we're going to buy 100 acres somewhere and build this million-dollar castle, you know, and live happily ever after. But that's hard to do, and it's not as realistic. And then there's another one where you're kind of occupying the existing fabric of the city, which is probably going to happen, and this is the permaculture reality, is how are we fixing the city? And then there's the actual idea of building a small intentional community where you're kind of inhabiting a small house or, sharing a house together or living on land together, which was what we did in Topanga, where we had about 20 people living together in a number of structures on one piece of land. And then you're forced to interact and share and try and make the environment better for yourself. So that middle level is the real cities that we live in, and this is what we have to do now, is we have to get together and create a needs and resources list with each other, because your neighbor probably has a perfectly good lawnmower, and if you don't have one, shouldn't you be able to use his, and then he can use your ladder, so you don't all have to own all of these things at the same time. That's a common thing that people are doing now, sharing resources in the neighborhood. But then we're looking at the possibility of creating a solar grid or array that's self-sustainable that maybe 5 to 10 different houses are using. So not every single house has to have its own solar array. You can have a system of modules in the park that then you can share the power from if you chip in on it. It kind of makes a lot more sense.
That's fantastic.
And there's, if you look at, go online and look at the Transition Town movement, there might be one in your city, and then you can start to tie in and network with your neighbors and see what's going on and promote that. And that would really help with these emergency situations, too. If you're just in touch with your, and you learn that there's a doctor living two doors down and you don't have to drive across town to see the specialist or, stuff like that, you learn who's in your neighborhood.
I'm elated to hear this information. That's so wonderful. And I want to make sure that people know how to reach you. And so is there a website or an email or a phone number? What's the best way to reach out for a consultation or to hire you to design for them or to create a community? There's so much that you do, and it's just each avenue, each arm, each little speck is so brilliant. And even just for you to be able to come in somebody's house and be able to tell them how they could be more sustainable and how they can live a better life, or whether it's creating, like you're saying, a transitional town or a conscious community or a cohesion within the community, or to build a brand new beautiful space just that has this just unlimited potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the best way is to reach me by email, and I'm really open to any kind of conversation or questions that people have on email. Or I'm traveling around a lot. I'm going out to New Mexico a lot. I'm going all around California, and I'd be happy to do some consultations. My email is jeffrey.collins@gmail.com, and that's spelled with one F, Jeffrey. It's GEOFREY. collins@gmail.com. And that's the best way to reach me.
That's fantastic. And then is there anything that you recommend for today's children or teens to be able to teach them or to step them into this idea of sacred architecture or being more connected with the planet or the earth?
That's a really good question. Well, I think in schools, there should be more education, first of all, on this fundamental level of what to do in an emergency. Like what I was just saying about, I hope that there's more education about how to create your own little generator from a bicycle and a car battery, or things like that at the most practical level. But it's hard to, I didn't necessarily have any training as a kid. It'd be great for kids to come out to building sites and really get what I got, which was sort of a whole different mind perspective, that what is built out there is the invention in someone's mind. That if you can train that in a child from an early age, then they would have the ability to research and train themselves in a completely different level. Because I think most of us go through life just assuming that the city is the way it is because it is what it is. And they're not getting that basic concept that it's all a creation, an invention, a fabrication. And it can be rearranged in any way you want. You know, because somebody did it at one point, and these kids are the ones that need to redesign the world, because it is kind of broken. A lot of the cities are stuck in a conventional mode that isn't designed for adaptation. So it's really important for the kids to learn to be the change agents, to be the people that are going to change the cities to be more sustainable and healthy. I'd love to teach a class.
Absolutely. Well, if you would like to teach a class, I am happy to help you arrange that, because certainly we have the space, you know, and the resources to do that, and I would love to be able to help you orchestrate that. So that would be my pleasure and joy, absolutely.
Sounds good.
I just absolutely love that. And then what is a bias well?
What?
What is a bias well?
A bias well?
Yes.
Well, I think you're referring to what is really at the most important forefront in permaculture, when it comes down to it, is creating water catchment over the land, and focusing the water in certain places so that it you can grow a food forest or things like that. There's this amazing, and this is what you propose. Like, if I were to go to someone's house, I would show, hey, let's, you design on contour something that is perfectly horizontal and may snake around the hills of your property, and then it will. That's where you plant all your food trees, so that you actually build up a big swale, and it's the first fundamental thing that leads to greater and greater levels or layers of abundance on your property, so that you can actually live off the land. And it's done on a large scale in the desert. I think even in Israel, they did this amazing experiment where they're having, or maybe it was Lebanon as well. They are creating these huge bioswales with tractors and creating a catch point for the water coming across the desert. And now they're growing trees in the middle of the desert that these people have never seen in millennia. So there's just some really smart design tricks. You know, they're actually going to do a green belt through the entire Sahara. This is being designed now. People are really starting to think about this. And it's as simple as creating a bioswale that catches the water in key points on the contour of the land. And it can just, it's the basis or the foundation of the possibility of a sustainable food forest.
What an exciting concept. I mean, it's funny how now we can think about creating something like this bioswale and that it's sustainable or can enrich us with this nutritious food or way of living. But if you think about how many years ago this was how we lived naturally and how far we've gotten away from living naturally to going back to the knowledge, and like you talk about that sacred architecture of being connected to the earth and being connected to what's naturally and readily available to us to be able to give us that abundance and that rich way of living. and that unlimited potential.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing to me that these, what we would consider almost ancient secrets or techniques, are really the golden nuggets of truth and gold for our lives.
Yes, yes. And it's at a time when I'm worried about our attention span and people's focus on fashion and stupid stuff on the internet, you know. I hope that we can introduce more of these essential concepts to everyone in the mainstream of how we can, you know, start to create a more sustainable world.
And I love also when you're talking about the global footprint, because I think that that's a term that we hear often in today's world, but we don't really have a connection or an understanding to it. If we say, oh, a certain company, XYZ, that's a famous shoe company or drink company or whatever that is leaving a global footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear that they're making a difference, but we don't know how or really what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about Burning Man, and I know that one of the truths of Burning Man and one of the missions and visions of Burning Man is what, to not leave a mark when you, that it's almost as if the earth is untouched when you leave?
Right. Well, I mean, everyone that's gone to Burning Man comes back changed. It will definitely make you question everything you see in the regular world, because you're introduced to these amazing concepts. The one you're referring to is Leave No Trace. And that's when, you know, you realize, oh, my God, they brought this 2-mile-wide city with streets and a fire department and 68,000 residents and all of their toys and millions of dollars of infrastructure. And then when they leave a couple of weeks later, it is completely gone. And when you go in there, you have to take out what you bring in. And you can't buy anything either. This is the major thing, is that it's entirely a gift economy. There's no money exchanged hands there. You come and you give. You have to bring something. There's only participants, no spectators. Everyone has to offer something, even if it's just being your sexy self, you know. You have to, we do a theme camp and we, you know, offer people to attend workshops and what have you. Other people, you know, hand out ice cream or food. And it forces you to recognize that there's things more important than money, and that you have to be completely responsible for yourself. And whatever you're throwing away right now, is there is no away, you know. If you're throwing a bunch of plastic in the trash and not thinking about recycling and just sending it straight to landfill, that's not okay. There's kind of a connection and a responsibility that we have, like it or not, to doing what's appropriate for our footprint on the planet. And we have this, it's really a critical time. A lot more people should be talking about this, I think, because I think everyone has a sense, a real solid sense that, you know, we're kind of messing up the planet, even more than 10 years ago. Don't you?
Absolutely. And I love that you talk about when you throw something away, because I remember that quote from Julia Butterfly Hill, who mm-hmm. is the woman that lived in the trees, and she would say, when you throw something away, where is a way?
Right. Right.
Where is the way? There is
no
way. No,
she's so cool. Exactly. I met her, and she reminds me of this basic concept. It's, yeah, the worst is when they dump it in the oceans and in the Pacific. It's unprecedented in the history of humankind. We never knew until recently that the plastic is just not breaking down, and there's huge, you know, gyres of spinning trash in the Pacific the size of Texas. That it will never go away. It's going to be there forever. Even if it breaks down into little pieces, the animals are eating it and dying by the thousands right now. We can never throw plastic away. It has to be recycled or disposed of properly, and you know, I don't think everyone gets that so much when they go to McDonald's and stuff a big thing of styrofoam and plastic in the trash. what is, you know, I don't know all of the solutions. I do see some problems, and I invite us all to consider what the best solutions would be.
I always think about that when you see all the fast food, all the little ketchup and the little mustard and the little relishes and these tiny little packs.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those tiny little packs is of plastic, and I always think it's crazy. It's so it's so amazing to me. And then I look at something like what you do in building entire communities of energy, of light, of space, of flow, of
mm-hmm.
brilliance, of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an entirely different way of thought, and it's an entirely different way of living, and there's no one listening to this call that cannot benefit and cannot take one step towards making a difference in their own lives, in their own world. And imagine if they created a huge step, and as you were talking about, like these earth stones, and an entirely different way of building and sustaining and self-sustaining
mm-hmm.
and sharing resources with our neighbor, like you're talking about a ladder and a lot. I mean, that makes so much sense. My next door neighbors borrow my folding chairs all the time, but that's about it.
Great.
And it's interesting because they used to come to me and they would ring my doorbell every so often, do you have any lemons? Do you have a lemon? Do you have a lemon? And finally one day I said, I have a lemon tree. I have a lemon. Here, you just come in my backyard and pick all of the fruit you'd like. But how wonderful
Great.
To be able to live that way, and
mm-hmm.
how wonderful to be able to build that way. And I'm so honored and so enriched and so blessed that that's the journey that you've stepped onto in the path, and that not only do you do it with such grace and such intentionality and such talent, but that you are so eager to share and that you've helped so many people in the process. It really is just so beautiful and so astonishing to me, and I'm so impressed, and I'm blown away by you and all that you do, and by your vision and your mission. So.
Oh, thank you very much, Nicole.
So appreciative.
Think locally, act or think globally, but act locally. That's another message. Just everyone can make a difference. Just make choices in what you buy. Buy organic foods. Try and buy as little packaging as possible. Support the right businesses and vote with your dollar. That's what I always say.
That's wonderful. So one more time, tell us again your email, just so we know how to reach you.
Thanks. It's jeffrey.collins@gmail.com. That's Jeffrey, collins, @gmail. And I have a new website coming out soon, so I'll share that with you soon.
Absolutely, and I'm happy to post it. And then what is, your business is Living Design. How did you come up with Living Design?
I just got a wake-up call. I was saying how I was working on a lot of fancy architecture in the 90s, and it was all about, the sort of scholastic, let's see how cool your building can be sort of thing. And I was doing SEO Studio, and it came out of that. And then that was with a former partner, and I didn't really have a connection to that anymore. And through this wonderful community I'm a part of, I was reminded of my more green roots and the more important messages at hand. And I kind of took a detour away from trying to be the super cool, famous, hotshot, architect that does cool buildings. But it's not about that. I kind of had a wake-up call. And also, I just wanted to challenge myself to really walk the walk. So I changed my firm name to my own name, Jeffrey Collins Living Design. And I believe that, any building that we build can use applications to make it a more healthy, vibrant, living space. And it's also about living. It's about people activating in the space. It's about working from the inside in. It's about building a house where people live. And architecture, my professor used to say, it's not architecture if it doesn't have bathrooms. Meaning that if it doesn't have that fundamental kind of practical, pragmatic level, like you should celebrate every intimacy of living when you design an architecture. It's not just about you know, this sculptural shell. It's more about the interactions with people.
I love that. Now, if it's not architecture, if it doesn't have bathrooms, what does the word architecture mean to you?
Well, architects would quantify it as architecture with a small A or architecture with a capital A. And architecture with a capital A takes all these things into account, the needs of the person, the layout of the building in relation to the environment, sustainability, and sacred geometry. I mean, at least for me, it creates a solution for living that is beautiful. It has three things: beauty, utility, and delight. That was also from Vitruvius. It has to have those. It's structure, utility, and delight. Structure has to be completely sound and really, you know, take care of you and be to code and be real, be built. Has to be delightful and beautiful. It has to give you a strong, memorable experience, and be extraordinary. And then it has to be practical. It has to be utility. You have to get everything working for the client. That's what architecture is.
Wow. I like this guy Vitruvius.
Yeah, he was cool. He was kind of like a Renaissance type man. And in the 10 books of architecture, he says how we need to pay attention to the skies and the celestial heavens and all these different things that you need to know as an architect.
Well, he was a very wise man, and certainly it's still a lot of wonderful, wonderful wisdom. And I thank you for, you know, sharing the seed of where all of that came from. And certainly I'm so appreciative of you taking your time out and being here today and sharing so much about sustainability and about green architecture and about smart designs and intentional communities and coherence and all of the possibilities and all of the ways in which we can live differently, because mm-hmm. that really is what unlimited life is about. It's the potentiality of being able to have that freedom in a whole new way. And I just think that this is just such amazing and important information, and certainly there's nobody that, you know, has this knowledge and this talent and the outreach in which to be able to actually share this at such a high level and such a beautiful level, bringing it into our homes and into our lives, than you do. And so I so appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, Nicole. It's my honor. Thank you for your, you know, framing it the way you have. You're such a great host for this kind of work.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you, and we look forward to having you back. And absolutely, please let us know about your website. We will make sure to post it, and it would be my honor, my privilege, you know, for any classes that you would like to put out there. I'm happy to help you do that, because certainly I know that people that are listening are just biting at the bit to learn all this information from you and to reach out to you. So I so appreciate you, and thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you, Nicole. It's really my pleasure.
Okay, well, we look forward to talking to you soon. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Okay, till next time, Nicole.
Wow. Jeffrey Collins, what an amazing guest. I mean, look at what he does. It's unbelievable. It's absolutely amazing. And as I was saying at the top of the show, honestly, that was my first impression. I watched this man building this entire structure, this entire community, and watching him create, watching him build was as natural for me as watching a dolphin swim in water. It just looked like he was part of the flow, part of the energy, that is what he was divinely meant to do. And then in meeting him, and you speak to him, and he is so knowledgeable and so wise, and look at all of his degrees and his past and his history and how deeply, you know, he has gone and dives in to the traditions and to the sacred and to the holy and to the land, into the communities, into the permits, into what's possible, and takes all of this information and brings it here, brings it around the world, builds in Japan, builds, I mean, just an incredible, incredible vast spectrum of beauty and energy and light, and the fact that we can do this for ourselves. We can, you know, have Jeffrey come into our very own home and say, this is a better way to live, and we can just make these small adjustments in our house and have our abundance change and our health change and our lives change. And just absolutely spectacular. Or we can have him build entire communities for us, or even brand new home and a brand new way of living and sustaining off the grid. And as he said, smart designs. And so I just, what wonderful information for everybody, and just so grateful that he took the time to be on the show. And this is a show that I will listen to it again and again, because there's so much information, just a wealth of, you know, wisdom and phenomenal things that you can do to be able to change your life. So just fabulous. And here locally, I'm part of the Los Angeles Beautification Team. And the Los Angeles Beautification Team plants all the trees in the poor neighborhoods, and they teach, you know, classes on sustainability to children. And so if you're interested in your own city, in your own state, or in your own country, of having classes like that, you know, please reach out, let me know. And if you're here in the Los Angeles community and you want to be part of the Los Angeles Beautification Team and you want to be part of beautifying the city in a whole new way, please let me know that as well, because we're always looking for people. And it's heroes like Jeffrey Collins to us that are our inspiration and that allow us to take these steps forward and forward and forward and make a difference in small ways and big ways throughout the city and the state, and certainly throughout the country and internationally. So we're just always excited to hear from you and always excited to have you be a part of it. So for today's guest, Jeffrey Collins, great thanks, green architecture, planning, living design, sacred architecture, and all of the different ways that we can live and sustain. We have incredible, unbelievably exciting shows lined up for you over the next few weeks, from new science to new technology to new medicine. And we even have somebody coming in that's going to talk about a way to just launch your business in a way that you never knew was possible without ever leaving your home, without ever actually leaving your conscious mind, and how you can create that entirely new platform of wealth and wisdom and abundance and opulence and all of these incredible things. So we're so excited for the upcoming shows. Today, great gratitude for our producer and, of course, for Jeffrey Collins, our extraordinary guest. This is Nicole Brandon with Unlimited Life, and we look forward to seeing you next week.